So a little bit of Parsha, Parsha's Kisisa. So I heard from Rav Yisrael Reisman Shlita that his Rebbe, Rav Pam Zatzal, would often say a shmooze in connection with the Shkalim of Parsha's Kisisa. This week is not Parsha Shkalim, but it is Parsha Shkalim. And Parsha's Kisisa is Parsha Shkalim. So the shmooze was based on a Mishnah in Masech Shkalim that we'll learn together and maybe take in a slightly different direction than Rav Pam Zatzal took the shmooze. A slightly different direction, not a very different direction. So first, a little bit of a background into Shkalim and how it works. So the Parsha about Machsa Shekel is, we often think of Machsa Shekel as that's how they would count the Jewish people. And that's true. It is how they would count the Jewish people. But the Machsa Shekel is not only relevant to the census that was done of the Jewish people. Every year, during the times of the Beis HaMikdash, each Jew would be obligated to pay a half a shekel tax, sometimes a higher amount, actually, depending on the needs of the Mikdash, but always the same amount for every Jew, rich or poor. Hashir lo yirbev adal lo yamit is a halacha. But the fact that it's actually a machsa shekel every year is actually not true, right? Meaning sometimes they needed a little bit more, so they would charge 3/4 of a shekel or whatever, or a whole shekel each year. But and that money went to pay for the karbanos hatzibur, and the collection would take place throughout Chodesh Adar, so that when Chodesh Nisan came along, they'd be ready to purchase all the new karbanos from the new shkalim. Good, you all know this. Now the yearly shkalim given during Adar were brought to the lishcha, and the lishcha b'shlosha prakim b'shana torminas lishcha. This is where the Mishnah's starting point, that three times a year a kohen would go in to the lishcha knee-deep in coins, right? There are all these coins all over the place, and he'd fill up boxes to pay for the karbanos. He'd take out three boxes of coins and use them to purchase the karbanos hatzibur. So that's what happened with the Machsa Shekel. Comes along the Mishnah in Masechta Shkalim. Mishnah in the third paragraph of Masechta Shkalim, Mishnah Beis. It says, when the kohen hatorim would go in, Ein hatorim nichnas lo bepargud chafus. He was not permitted to wear clothing that had a hem on them, that had a hem on the bottom of the pants or whatever he was wearing, could not have a hem in the clothing. The concern is that he could steal coins if he has a hem in the clothing, right? A little bit unusual, because really, that's what we're going to be so concerned about. You know, I don't know, when I go to the tailor and they ask me, do you want a cuff or not? I say, I don't know, what are other people getting? And they tell me what's in style, and then I just tell them, I say, okay, do that. So, but apparently, if I was a Kohen, I would have to say, no cuff, because if there's a cuff, then they're going to be choshed that I'm stealing money. But it doesn't stop there. V'lo b'minol, v'lo b'sandal, v'lo b'tfilin, v'lo b'kameya. He's not allowed to wear shoes or sandals or tefillin or any sort of amulet. And the Mishnah explains, because we're concerned that, you know, what you could do with tefillin, you could, before you go in, remove all the parshios from the tefillin, and then when you go in, you'll open up the tefillin and you'll stick coins in the how many coins can you fit in the tefillin already? You have to hollow it out. You can stick some coins in the tefillin, close it back up, sew it back up with the gidin, and then you walk out, and it will be the perfect crime, and no one will suspect, and you'll be able to steal the money. That's what we're concerned about. The guy who we hire to be the one, after a thorough interviewing process, no doubt, the one who we trust to be the one, to be Torim Velishcha, that's the guy who we're concerned might stick some coins in his tefillin to leave, to steal from the Beis HaMikdash. That's what, it reminds me, Rav Shechter told us, was the hafla. He said in the shir recently, I think, I was just listening in the car recently, that he said the hafla was a Hasidish Rav. He was a Talmud of the Maggid of Mezerich, and the hafla was a Rav in a German city. So even though he was a Talmud of the Maggid of Mezerich, he was a Chassid, but he couldn't play Chassid because he was, he was a Rav in a German city. So in Germany, everyone wears tefillin on Chol HaMoed. So the Hafla had tefillin on Chol HaMoed also, but he had a special pair of tefillin for Chol HaMoed that no one was allowed to touch and no one was allowed to look at. And then after he died, they opened up his Chol HaMoed tefillin and they saw that they were empty. There were no parshiyos in there. So he couldn't do it. He was a chassid. He couldn't wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. So if you have the Hafla's tefillin, the Hafla's Chol HaMoed tefillin, then you'd be the Kohen, be able to stick in in the coins to steal from the lishcha. And the Mishnah says, and so what? So what if he steals? Or so what if he has the ability to steal? Not that we're concerned he's actually going to steal, but we're concerned that he's going to have the ability to steal. And then says the Mishnah, what's going to happen? Shema ye'ani, whatever happens next is going to be a problem. Because if he becomes poor, v'yomru me'avon ha'lishcha'heni. Everyone's going to say, oh, I know why he became poor. It's because he was stealing, so Hashem punished him by making sure that he loses all of his money. Or, Oshemi Ya'ashir, or maybe he'll become very wealthy. V'yomru mitrumas alishcha ha'ashir. And everyone's going to say, oh, I know how he became rich. He became rich off the backs of Klal Yisrael by taking all of their money and stealing it from the lishcha. So if he'd become poor, people would say it's divine retribution for stealing. If he'd become wealthy, people would say that his wealth was because of the stealing. And the Mishnah explains that it's important that the Kohen be above suspicion, because the Torah says, V'yisim nekiyim me'ashem mi'Yisrael. You have to protect your reputation, not only in the eyes of Hashem, but even in the eyes of a fellow Jew as well. And then the Mishnah continues, V'omer u'matzachein v'seichel tov v'ein elokim v'adam. A pasuk in Mishlei that you have to make sure that you find chein v'ein elokim v'adam. Not only v'ein elokim, but also v'ein adam. Also in people's eyes as well. So I got a bunch of kashas over here. Let's do three questions, right? Question number one. How common was it exactly for people to hide money in their shoes? Like, was this a problem that they had? That this was something that they were concerned about? You know, post 9/11, it used to be, you guys don't even remember such a thing, but there was such a thing before 9/11 where you were allowed to just walk into an airport with your shoes and never have to take them off, right? You could just go in with your shoes. You know why you have to take off your shoes by security? Because there was one Meshugna, one time, that tried to put an explosive device in his shoe. It's a good thing he didn't try to put an explosive device in his underwear, because then they changed all the rules because he tried to put an explosive device in his shoe. So for that one Meshugna, they changed all the rules. Even if that were a legitimate concern, that a person is going to put the money in the shoe, how big a concern is it that people would hide money in their tefillin? You know, was this a common problem? Is this something that really reasonably we had to be choshish for? Second of all, when describing what people will suspect about, you know, what if you could interview these people before anything happens and say, what would happen next that would make you suspicious of this man? What would they tell us? Would they tell us, well, if he becomes poor, we'll be suspicious of him? Or would they tell us, if he becomes rich, we'll be suspicious of him? Meaning, it's a stira, right? Either way, the Mishnah says, whether he becomes poor or whether he becomes rich, they're going to be suspicious of him. If he becomes poor, they're going to say, oh, it must be that it's divine retribution. There's a God that runs the world. If he becomes rich, then they're not going to believe in God anymore. It's not that God is running the world. No, he's rich because he stole from the Lishka. Which is it? Meaning, what? It's a stira from one concern to the other. So is it that people will suspect him of stealing if he becomes poor, that people suspect him of stealing if he becomes wealthy? And finally, the end of the Mishnah, this is the most fundamental question, the end of the Mishnah tries to prove that you have to be beyond reproach, and it quotes two psukim. First pasuk is a pasuk in the Torah, and it expresses the message pretty unequivocally, V'yisim nekiyim me'ashem me'yisrael. You need to be beyond suspicion even from other people. Nothing vague about that pasuk, right? That is about as clear a pasuk as you could have. I remember when I was teaching in DRS, there still is a Rebbe in DRS, Rabbi Klapholz, an outstanding Rebbe, who would write on the board each time before each test, V'yisim nekiyim me'ashem me'yisrael, that if I suspect you of cheating, even if you're innocent, then you're in violation of that pasuk, and therefore it's fundamentally problematic, because you're not, even if you're Naki Me Hashem, you're not Naki Me Yisrael. So that's a great pasuk. Why then do we need Ve'omer, a pasuk in Mishlei? Pasuk in Torah wasn't good enough. Ve'omer, u'matzachem v'seichel tov v'ein elokim v'adam. What does that pasuk add that the first pasuk doesn't already have? So I think this is based on what Rav Pam Shmuz, that the Mishnah is teaching us a lesson about the mentality of the masses. If the masses want to accuse somebody, they'll interpret either outcome to fit their narrative. Meaning, if they don't like the guy who's going in to take the Trumas Alishcha, whatever happens, they've already written the story in their heads that this guy's a bad guy. And therefore, whatever happens next, they're going to fit the narrative that they've already written in their heads. If people are intent on bringing down a leader and assuming terrible things about him, they'll do that, no matter what the evidence. They'll find the evidence to back up their narrative. Do people become poor as a divine punishment for stealing? Does that ever happen, that someone becomes poor as a divine punishment for stealing? I'm sure it does. Is that the only reason people become poor? That's not the only reason people become poor. I'm sure the holy Tana Hillel would have something to say about that, right? That's not the reason that he was poor. Do people become wealthy from stealing? I'm sure people become wealthy from stealing. I'm sure there are people that run these amazing Ponzi schemes or whatever, and they steal all this money, and they're very, very wealthy. Is that the only way that people become wealthy? I would hope not. I would think that that is not the only way that people become wealthy. The holy Tana Reb Elazar ben Charsum would probably tell us that that's not the only way that people become wealthy. So why is it that people are going to suspect, if this guy becomes poor, it must be because he stole. If he becomes wealthy, it must be because he stole. It's not because it must be. It doesn't must be. There are many wealthy people and many poor people that have nothing to do with stealing. It's because they already decided that this guy's a nice barf and that this guy's a bad guy, and therefore whatever happens, they're going to fit their narrative into the facts. They'll fit the facts into their narrative. And that speaks to the great, great challenge of fulfilling the Yisim Nikiyim, because whatever you do and whatever befalls you will invite the naysayers to naysay, and will invite cynics to be cynics, and they'll be cynical no matter what, because that's the kind of people they are. In fact, the Chasam Sofer in the Tshuva and Chelek Vav and Simin Nun Tes writes to a Talmud. He said, I could see from your letter that you're not being careful in the matter of Yisim Nikiyim and whatever the union was. And the Chasam Sofer says, Kol yomai hayisi mitzta'er al mikra zev Yisim Nikiyim Hashem Yisrael. My whole life, I always struggled with Yisim Nikiyim Hashem Yisrael. Yoser efshar lotzei sidei shamayim harbe yoser mi lotzei sidei abrios. It's so much easier to be yotzei yidei shamayim than it is to be yotzei yidei habrios. Va'uncho yoser kasha ma'od. And the punishment for not being Yotzei Yedei Abrios is a greater punishment. Far easier to avoid wrongdoing in the eyes of Hashem than to avoid wrongdoing in the eyes of other people. The Jewish people were a cynical bunch. And it's very hard to win over a cynic. It's very hard to convince a cynic not to be cynical. And the Chasam Sofer continues, Eini kedai lahaskir avonos kedoshim, mikol makom torihi. He says, I'd hate to identify great people in history who failed in this area, but I have to explain a parsha in the Torah. He says, B'nei Gad, B'nei Ruvein, receive a piece of land be'evar yardein, and then fulfilled the condition in leading Klal Yisrael in battle, but they weren't mekayim v'yisim nekiyim, because people were choshed that they wanted the land because they were too lazy to go to battle, and that's why they went into Golas first, because people were choshed them that was their angle, even though they followed through and they kept the condition and they said no we'll go into battle first and we'll do it, and they did it. But once people are choshed them, they've already failed in v'yisim nekiyim. So given all of that, if the Jewish people are so cynical, and you know, especially talking to people who, a good percentage of the people sitting in front of me right now are going to be in positions of Jewish leadership, and they're always out to get you, right? Meaning, if that's true of the Jewish people, that they're such a cynical bunch, and they'll attack you regardless of what you do, how does one go about fulfilling this mitzvah? Chasam Sofer said it's hard. Okay, but it's got to be doable. Hashem doesn't give us a mitzvah that's not doable. How does one fulfill this mitzvah? What kinds of safeguards would protect a person from the cynical and suspicious eyes of their fellow Jews? And I think the answer is that no matter how you behave in a given situation, nothing can protect you from suspicion. Meaning, if the Kohen HaTorim were to first think about how to avoid suspicion when he enters the Lishcha, he's way too late. If you were to first think about, you know, what kinds of safeguards do I need to make sure that no one suspects me of anything, he's way too late. People by nature form opinions of other people, and they'll interpret their behaviors in a way that fits their opinion. Meaning they'll say to themselves, oh, wow, he doesn't have a hem in his garment, he doesn't have tefillin, he doesn't have, how did he do it? How did he steal? Meaning, they'll figure it out. Oh, he must be. He took, he swallowed it, and then, you know, like a drug smuggler or whatever. You know, they'll come up with something, because people are cynical. You know, not to get political, but if you recall about a year ago, there was a huge controversy surrounding the governor, the then governor of the state of New York, and there were all sorts of accusations against him. I mean, again, the accusations are terrible. Governor should never behave that way. Posh, right? Are those the worst accusations against a politician you've ever heard? I mean, there are people that rose to much higher power than governor who had much, much worse accusations against them, right? Why is it? You know, it was amazing. You know what you didn't hear from anybody, not a Democrat, not a Republican, not an independent? No one said, how can we do this to this guy? How can we take down an innocent man? How can we take down a guy for just misunderstanding and not speaking that? No one came to his defense. No one. You know what you heard from everybody? could have happened to a nicer guy. You know, like everyone was like, yeah, the guy's a jerk. Let him burn. You know, it's essentially what happened because no one liked him and no one likes you. No one's going to defend you. Okay, that was a little too political maybe. But I think the point is that it's not political, that it doesn't matter. All the Democrats were like, yeah, he's a jerk. Let him burn. Like no one cared. Why did no one care? Because everyone just needed an excuse. And as soon as the excuse came to take him out of power, great, let's do it. Let's take him down. When you're arrogant and self-centered, people will jump at the opportunity to dismiss you and to lower you. A more lovable and a humble person likely would have had supporters defending him. The way to avoid suspicion and people assuming the worst about you is not to wait till you're in a position where they have something to suspect and to try to make safeguards. No, it's to become the kind of person that people want to like, that people want to think the best about you. If our every interaction is pleasant and we exude humility and genuine care, nobody's going to be looking to find fault in our actions, even when there might be room to interpret some fault. They'll be down the kaf schus because you want to be down the kaf schus someone that you love. So if you become that person that everybody loves, then they'll be down the kaf schus. And I think this yesod of developing our relationship with others to the point that they want to think the best of us is the key to v'yisim nikiyim. It's common for people, is it actually common for people to hide money in their shoes or in their tefillin? Of course not. But it doesn't have to be common for somebody to look for fault in us. If we're unlikable and we're arrogant people, they'll always assume the worst. Is it contradictory to believe that a person being poor and being rich are both proofs that he's dishonest? Of course. But the evidence isn't really what matters. The narrative that already exists based on the relationship, that's what matters. I heard Rabbi Breidowitz say in one of his Q&As that one of the big brains behind the Bible codes. You familiar with the Bible codes? Okay, Shatar is very into this. I think so one of the big people that really believes in the Bible codes. It's a big controversy whether, both from a Torah perspective and from a mathematical perspective, whether you should believe in the Bible code, that there's something to it. But one of the big believers in the Bible code, Rabbi Breidowitz said, is someone who's an avowed atheist. But he is absolutely certain that the Bible codes are they're too big of an anomaly to not be true, and that it has to be that in this document there are allusions to every historical event that's at, but there's no God, right? And he said, no. Obviously, someone at some point in a future generation has already developed the technology for time travel, and they traveled back in time and wrote this document and encoded in this document everything that... Now, let me ask you, what's more likely over here? Right? I mean, of the two scenarios, either that there is a God, as most of humankind has believed since the beginning of time, or that there was a time traveler who brilliantly encoded within a document that he wrote when he traveled back in time everything that was going to happen in the future. Meaning, the guy doesn't believe in God, so whatever he's going to come up with is not going to believe in God. When you have a narrative, that's going to be, you know, when all the facts are going to fit into your narrative. That's the way you're going to be. It already exists based on your relationship, based on, what your beliefs are. And maybe that's why the Mishnah quotes the second pasuk. Mishnah is telling us that there's really only one way to fulfill the Yisim Nekiyah Me'Hashem Yisrael. You have to fulfill the Yisim Nekiyah Me'Hashem Yisrael. And the Mishnah says, you know how to do that? Umatza chein v'seichel tov bein elkim v'adam. Not at that moment. You have to live your entire life by being matza chein, by being the kind of person that has that special chein, that people will look at you and they're going to only think the best of you. You know, I read a biography not that long ago, a rabbinic biography. I'm very into the art scroll rabbi biographies. I'm not against the art scroll biographies at all. I don't care that it only gives you the good stuff. I don't want to hear the bad stuff. So there was a biography of Shlomo Gissinger. I was very excited about the biography because I never heard of Shlomo Gissinger. I didn't know who he was. So I was excited to learn about him. And he was a rav in Lakewood. After reading the biography, I got the sense, any West Hempstead people here? No West Hempstead people here? So I got the sense that he was like the Rav Kelmer of the Lakewood world, meaning he was a guy who was a huge Talmud Chacham, and he spent every waking hour doing chesed and running around taking care of people and doing he was the Rav Kelmer of the Lakewood world. And it said that he was this Rav of a large shul in Lakewood, and every week he'd show up late for Kabbalah Shabbos. He was never on time for Kabbalah Shabbos, and yet nobody thought less of him. Nobody said, so what's he doing? He can't show up on time. Because everyone knew. Everyone knew that every moment of every day was taken up with extraordinary acts of chesed. You read the book. It's really remarkable. you know, if I would show up late for Kabbalah Shabbos, you know, they would that I would be the topic of conversation at people's Shabbos tables. They believe the rabbi is nice far if he's doing nothing. He's what's he so busy with? He doesn't even have to go to YU on Fridays. Like, what, you know, like, it would be, and rightfully so, because I give nobody any reason to like me. But you have someone who people admire like that. You know, I actually mentioned this to someone from West Hempstead, and they said, yeah, Rav Kelmer was never on time. he was always late, especially Erev Shabbos, because he had to get to every hospital to be able. Sometimes he'd walk in like 3 hours after Shabbos started, and he'd walk into the shul. There were a few people learning. Jeremy Teichman told me the story that he was supposed to speak to a young chevra that came to learn after their suda on Friday night, and he comes in schwitzing. It's like 85 degrees outside. It's like 3.5 hours after Shabbos started, and he said, "I'll be right back to give a dvar Torah. I just have to go home and make kiddush for my wife." He hadn't been home. He walked like 8 miles from a hospital somewhere. Meaning, if you're that kind of person, you know, they say that people in West Hempstead don't know what it is that they never had the experience, they never even heard of the concept that around the Shabbos table you speak Lashon Hara about the rabbi, you know, like that you make fun of the rabbi's drasha or whatever. Never heard of it. They never heard of such a concept, because there was never, who would ever do that? Like, you'd have to be the biggest Russia in the world to do that with Rav Kelmer. So the key is to be that kind of person. So the message, I think, is twofold, that we could all stand, first of all, to be a little less cynical. It would be good if the Jewish people were a little less cynical. If we're constantly interpreting data about others in a negative way, it might say more about our attitude toward that person than about the person's actual behavior. But also, and primarily, the way to avoid cynicism, the way to avoid criticism, is not only through transparency and care and not wearing the tefillin into the lishka and not wearing the shoes and no hems, please, but through the cultivation of positive relationships where everybody we meet should think of us and say, you know, I really like that guy. That person seems genuine and kind. And when you have those kinds of relationships, then you're able to fulfill v'yisim nekiyim me'Hashem Yisrael.